thank you all for coming out this morning. We know this is the early session of the day, and a very interesting topic, right, compared to the demos we've done the last couple days. So here's EXL, what are we on? EXL 321, which is Microsoft Link 2013 preview, setup and deployment. My name is Andrew Aronsing. I work for MCS out of Chicago in the U.S. And cover our UC portfolio of Exchange and Link. And with me today is Ewan McKellar.
Hi, my name is Ewan. I'm currently working as a beta support engineer for the TAP program. So for TAP customers around the world who are deploying Link 2013, if they have any issues, the bugs come through to me, and I have a look at them, escalate them to the product group if required, or help the guys fix them. So I've had a lot of good experience with that so far.
Excellent. Thank you. So, standard disclaimer, as we're showing you pre-release software, all information subject to change, right, prior to RTM. Our goal is to ship Microsoft Link 2013 later this year. But, of course, anything that we show you today may change prior to that release date as we're still in process making the code. Guidance you have now is latest. We were actually making some changes this morning still, actually, so we're updating as we see the guidance or knowledge in real time here. Hopefully you'll use this, and we don't expect substantial changes, but of course things could change between now and the final release. Goal of this session is to give you an understanding of the setup changes in Link Server 2013. If you're familiar with Link Server 2010, you'll see a lot of the tools are the same. We'll kind of cover the highlights of what's changed in that setup experience for 2013. And as well to go through some of the migration capabilities. So what versions of OCS and Link are supported for migration paths? What's some of our coexistence options around things like voice and client versions and other things that you'll have to go through if you have an existing version of OCS 2007 R2 or Link Server 2010 that you want to migrate to Link Server 2013. We'll also show you a demo. Ewan's got a couple of the tools we use for planning and for setting and configuring Link Server 2013. This demo does not rely on the other areas. We shouldn't have any external participation, so we shouldn't have the security issues we had yesterday afternoon in the meeting session. If you were there yesterday, we had a demo with the Polycom folks over at the booth scheduled for like 5:30, 5:45. We were told that the booth area would close at 6 p.m., and at like 5:30, the folks started IMing us from over there saying, hey, security's kicking us out. can we move the demo up a little bit? So, all right, first slide. Now, if you hadn't seen the architecture session, we'll give you a quick summary of what's changed in Link Server 2013. Working from the outside in, on the edge server, we now support XMPP as well as federation with Skype. So in the past, we had SIP federation that would go to LCS, OCS, and Link organizations, as well as the public IM providers of AOL, Yahoo, and Windows Messenger. Now we have the capability to add Skype and XMPP-based services, such as Google Talk and Jabber, directly from Edge. In the past, you had, for XMPP, for example, you needed a separate XMPP gateway. We've moved those XMPP services directly onto the Edge server with a service component running on the front-end server inside, essentially to simplify the topology of the deployment. Internally, we've also made a lot of changes. The major change is there's no longer the concept of a dedicated or the option for a dedicated AV conferencing pool. As server hardware has grown in terms of number of cores that can be supported and the processing power there, we just moved the AV conferencing service directly onto the front-end server. We have enough processing or CPU capacity there. Our availability is better as well. Instead of, for example, two front-end servers in a pool and two AV MCU servers in a dedicated AV pool, we'd recommend just having four all-in-one servers. That way we can withstand more losses in that pool. You have a simpler deployment topology to support going forward. We've also moved the archiving and monitoring service to be co-located on the front-end server. Those used to be separate server roles in Link 2010 and prior as well. So you can see more of these services moving from the dedicated server roles onto that front-end server role as we have that hardware capacity that we can take advantage. We've also got mobile and Link web app running on the front-end server. That also reduces or simplifies your deployment topology by having that concept of a all-in-one or kind of a brick server around that. The one optional component that's separate is the persistent chat pool. That is our rename for the concept of group chat in Link 2010 and prior. The persistent chat is now a fully-fledged Link role. It will be managed and supported via tools like Topology Builder and the planning tool versus having sort of its own setup and management experience that we saw in prior versions. Our integration with the PSTN is the same. You might have a gateway. You might have a SIP trunk. SIP trunk can go to a carrier. SIP trunk could go to a internal IP PBX or IPT phone system internally. The termination point for that SIP trunk would be a mediation service. That mediation service could be co-located on the front-end servers. We do still provide the option to break out the dedicated mediation server role. In some cases, when terminating a SIP trunk from a provider, they want that to be a separate box or separate role, and so we provide that capacity of breaking that out if so be desired. In terms of our ancillary roles, we obviously still require Active Directory. A link stores all of our user and authentication and access control information in Active Directory, so we don't have a separate management or user interface or user database that we have to support. The monitoring database, even though the front-end server is capturing those call detail records being submitted by the clients or endpoints, that information being queued up on the front-end servers is eventually sent back to one of the SQL instances to capture that call detail records and provide you reporting as well as information on calls and the metrics around those calls in your organization. We've had support for Exchange, which is our voicemail platform for Link and prior versions of OCS. The change for Link Server 2013 is that Exchange Server 2013 also now supports being the archiving repository for Link. So with Link 2010 and prior, if you wanted to do archiving or capturing of instant messages that were sent in the org, we would capture those with the archiving server and store them in a SQL database. With 2013, the endpoints will submit those IM conversations off to the front-end servers. The front-end servers will then capture and queue those and submit them either to the existing archiving SQL database you have or to an Exchange 2013 server if you have one deployed, so you have a single archiving and compliance story or solution inside of the organization. So Exchange is still the voicemail platform and optionally the archiving storage platform for Link Server 2013. System Center is still our recommended management tool. Some changes around System Center and management is now we have the capability for viewing trends in our call detail records database. So not only can we look at individual link component server health and things like event logs and disk space and processor utilization, but we can do some real-time reporting on the data that's being fed into our monitoring server database to say, oh, look, calls to site locate, to location X, for example, are trending yellow or trending red. There looks like some, maybe a wireless access point issue, a switch issue, a WAN link issue, right? Something is affecting call quality to a specific location, and we'll get a real-time alert generated on that. The final optional or ancillary component is the WAC role or web access components. This role is not a link server role, but is part of the office server roles, which essentially allows for rendering of office documents to a browser in a very robust and clear manner. This is a role developed by the office team themselves, and so therefore rendering of things such as PowerPoints that are uploaded to Link will include support for things like streaming audio and streaming video. So we have a more robust method of essentially streaming out office content to browser-based clients if you have the WAC role. If you don't, you'll still use the Link rendering engine that we've had in 2010 and prior. If you have the WAC role, you get a better rendering experience for those office documents. So I wanted to give you the quick overview. As you can see, this is vastly simplified compared to Link 2010 or earlier versions where we were breaking out all sorts of different server roles in the organization. Main summary around that, right, is as the hardware capacity increases, we now have the capacity to run more co-located services on a specific single instance or maybe multiple instances for availability, which simplifies the deployment and has less moving parts or less complexity, essentially, to ensure higher availability and higher uptime. So with that, let's take a look at our setup flow for Link Server 2013. First process of what you're going to do in an organization to deploy or plan for Link 2013 is go through our infrastructure requirements. So we'll cover later on what some of the hardware specs are, and this is specifically, especially around hardware specs. This is all draft guidance or what we're providing the TAP customers at this time. This one we expect to be refined or more granularly provided right as we get closer to RTM. But we have a tool, the planning tool that Ewan's going to show us later, which takes some metrics around how many users, what type of modalities, are they IM-only users, conferencing users, are they enterprise voice users, do they have persistent chat, do you want high availability, for example, and that will spit back what our hardware and infrastructure requirements would be. We can have those hardware requirements either be physical, we can deploy all of our Link Server 2013 roles on physical hardware, or those hardware requirements can be virtual, and we can provision those inside of a virtual infrastructure. We'll also provide you later on some of this draft guidance around virtualization, or our virtualization support stance for Link Server 2013. We also require the concept of a file share. Link Server 2013 stores all of the attachments that users upload to a conference, as well as things like polls and whiteboard sessions, or meeting content that gets uploaded, or provisioned during a meeting, onto a file share in an encrypted structure matched back to the conference organizer. So that file share, we now support on DFS to make that file share highly available in an organization. We used to look at things such as clustering for file services to provide that. DFS makes it relatively straightforward for us to have a file share in one location, replicated to a second location. If our link pool, we have the pool resilience option or paired pool option, and we fail over to the other location, we're therefore able to leverage that file share content in the other location and provide that meeting content for people joining meetings on their backup pool. We also have the concept of our IIS and certificate config. Link has this option of what we call simple URLs. These simple URLs would be your meet or your join URL, so something like join.contoso.com or meet.contoso.com, which provides users a standard prefix that they use when clicking to join a meeting. That join then will either join them to a meeting using the Link web app or browser client, if they don't have Link or the attendee client installed, or if they have the full client installed, that Link will redirect them to the full client experience for the meeting join process. It would also include their dial-in conferencing URL. This would allow them to change their dial-in conferencing PIN, for example, or to look up a local access phone number. If you've got multiple locations or regions around the world that have phone numbers that allow you to dial into a Link meeting. And so this concept of simple URLs is just, what do you call it? Is it dialin.contoso? Is it phone.contoso? Is it meet.contoso? Join.contoso? Relatively simple, one would think, but often, since this is exposed on the public internet, we often find that organizations spend quite a bit of time trying to evaluate how they want to define or name these public-facing URLs. Once we have those URLs defined, we're then able to go through our public certificate requests. For some organizations, that can take some time, and so therefore we recommend starting that public request once you've got those URLs defined for your public namespace. Once we have that knowledge, our next process is to go through and define the topology. So we kind of have an idea of what the topology will look like from the planning wizard in terms of server counts and server roles. But we've got additional information that we'll define in Topology Builder, which would be specifically the server names, fully qualified domain names, IP addresses, the back-end SQL database that an Enterprise Edition pool would use, for example. If you're using SQL to do your archiving instead of Exchange to do your archiving, you're defining that SQL instance. So in essence, the configuration of the topology that you would deploy for Link Server 2013. If you're familiar with Link Server 2010, the concept of Topology Builder is relatively straightforward. If you're using OCS 2000 R2 or prior, the reason we made this change is that we used to deploy our infrastructure with OCS by running setup, and then post-setup, you would launch a Microsoft Management Console, and you would configure that specific server with the information it needed, which services were installed, what's the configuration of those services, what's the URL configuration, et cetera, other detailed analysis like that. The catch is that because you're doing this individually on a server-by-server basis, we would find inconsistencies, often just due to administrator error or mistakes, and or sometimes people would deploy OCS R2 and then configure it in a way that would be unsupported from a Microsoft perspective. And then we'd have some technical problems or issues, doing troubleshooting, we kind of do some research and we find out there was a mistake at the configuration level. With Topology Builder, we've reversed the process. And so essentially we take the concept of defining your topology up front, and Topology Builder won't allow you to define a topology that's not supported. And so by going through and doing the research and coming up with the names, IP addresses, namespaces, everything else up front, we find that rather than going to the server part and then having to scramble back and find the info, more due diligence is provided up front. You have the master plan of what the environment looks like. Once Topology Builder is complete, we literally can just go to each server, runs setup. Setup looks at this master topology builder file and installs the relevant roles and performs all the configuration required for that server. A difference between Link Server 2013 and 2010 is that we've added support for things like persistent chat, the web access components, and exchange archiving, or the new feature sets directly into topology builder versus having that be a separate configurable item. So now topology builder is the master plan for your organization. You always define your infrastructure in topology builder, then go and run setup on the servers post that. If later you need to make a change in the organization, you define that change in topology builder. Once you define the change, if a setup is required, for example, one of the server roles, topology builder will tell you you need to go rerun the bootstrapper on server roles X and Y. You rerun this bootstrapper process, it picks up the change, installs or modifies or removes the relevant components, and then you've got a reconfigured Link environment, ensuring that it meets all of our supported guidance and will be properly configured for operation. Topology Builder relies on a concept called the Central Management Store. The Central Management Store is the definition, or essentially an XML file, of that topology you design in Topology Builder that has a copy replicated to every individual Link server. One copy of the CMS, or Central Management Store, is read-write, or the master CMS. That's the one when you're editing in Topology Builder that you'll publish against. Once that read-write replica is updated, Link has a process to automatically replicate those changes to all Link servers in the organization. At that point, all the servers will pick up the change, and they're aware of that new topology information. The reason we have it replicated to all servers is we want all the servers to be autonomous. We don't want them depending on a single read-write replica. If that were to go down, them not being able to start up or boot their services because they don't have the information. So if we lose the master replica, the individual Link servers will continue to operate. They all have the current version of the topology builder file locally in their version of the CMS. We just cannot make any read-write changes until we restore or recover that master CMS replica. Once we've defined that topology, our next process is to do something called publish. And so in publishing the topology in the topology builder tool, we're essentially pushing that XML file from our local copy of topology builder into this master read-write CMS. From the master read-write CMS, that is then replicated out to any existing running Link servers. If this is a new install, we only have one copy of the CMS, which would be published to, if we're running standard edition server, the first standard edition that we deploy in the organization will have a read-write copy of the CMS. If we're deploying an enterprise edition pool, the first SQL instance that's used as a back-end pool instance for our first enterprise edition pool will have that read-write copy of the CMS. So once we publish the topology, it's available there. We also publish a service connection point record in Active Directory. And so when we have our subsequent Link servers that need to be installed, they're already domain joined. When we run Link setup on that server, it queries Active Directory for the SCP. SCP points to the master read-write replica of Topology Builder. We install a local copy of SQL Express on that Link server role, replicate the master CMS to a read-only copy on that local instance, and then we're able to provision that Link server based on that local copy. The final portions would be then going and configuring certificates internally. So we have the concept of our externally available certificates that are published out to the internet, but we also require certificates on our internal Link servers. These certificates are used for server-to-server authentication using a new protocol called Open Authentication. It's also used for encryption for any server-to-server or client-to-server traffic, allowing TLS or MTLS to be used so that all traffic, client-to-server and server-to-server, whether it be signaling traffic or media traffic, is encrypted inside of the organization. We have the option for enabling Kerberos. By default, when you deploy OCS or Link 2013, NTLM V2 is the default authentication mechanism. NTLM V2 has some scalability issues in larger organizations. And so enabling Kerberos, or defining a service account for Kerberos, we have a little script and some guidance that allows you to enable or to create the service account and provision it on your pools, allows you to use Kerberos authentication for your users to sign in and authenticate to their Link infrastructure. Just like in Link 2010, the first authentication process from a client would be using NTLM V2 or Kerberos if you've enabled Kerberos. Once they've logged on, there will actually be a certificate provision down to the client, and the client will use a TLS DSK certificate authentication for future authentication requests to offload some of that authentication from the AD infrastructure. So once you've went through this process, you've essentially defined your topology, you've published that topology, ran setup on the servers, which has interrogated that topology and then installed the appropriate or relevant roles, and there's no post-configuration, right? The only post-configuration items that we have are installing those certificates, where we have to do a certificate request from a internal or external PKI infrastructure, and enabling Kerberos using a script if we optionally want to add that step. But we don't have the option where you're going into an MMC and configuring services to stop or start or changing ports or anything like that post-setup. All that information is defined in Topology Builder up front, and then changes to that topology over time would also be defined in Topology Builder and pushed out or replicated to the individual link servers. So let's take a look. A couple other changes. First of all, when defining our SQL instance, we have more options around defining the paths. We had some options in Link 2010 that didn't always work as expected or what it might have appeared to lead to from the text in the dialog box. But with 2013, we now have the option to use the database paths, right, that are defined in the SQL instance itself, our default SQL paths, or provide a database path map for our database paths themselves. This allows us some more granularity in terms of scripting or provided automating installs of where to place the database paths and log files for our SQL instances on Enterprise Edition pools or something like an archiving server role for a backend to SQL. And so we have this option both in the GUI for Topology Builder as well as via PowerShell. So depending on which option or choice you take for deploying your SQL instance, we now provide more flexibility in terms of carving out those paths. We've also heard a lot of feedback that customers want the ability to rapidly provision servers using a sysprepped image. And so we've provided some guidance on how to use a sysprepped master image with Link joined to the domain and be able to pull that topology information down and run the appropriate setup for the Link server roles that are being deployed. We didn't have that support for sysprep images in prior versions of Link, but we understand a lot of you use sysprep as your server deployment method. This is especially relevant in the virtual space where we see the concept of a master image that's prepared, and then that image is replicated or built new for additional VM guests that might be deployed. There are some additional prerequisites. We use PowerShell version 3, .NET Framework 4.5, which are the newest instances or iterations of those technologies, as well as something called Windows Identity Foundation, which we use to kind of replicate or provide some options around our open authentication capabilities. And I've got a slide coming up that talks a little bit more about this OAuth capacity. Bootstrapper is a process that we run to pick up the changes in Topology Builder and make those requested changes on the local server when required. For example, we might have moved the mediation service off of our front-end pool onto some dedicated mediation servers in Topology Builder. We would then need to rerun Bootstrapper on those front-end roles to deinstall that mediation server on those specific front-end roles. Bootstrapper has had support for that capability in Link 2010. What we've added in 2013 is the capabilities around persistent chat and the XMPP gateway translating service. This ensures that all the functionality in Link now is defined and provided by a topology builder. We no longer have any services or components that don't leverage a topology builder and Bootstrapper functionality for their configurable aspects. We also have this new concept of OAuth for server-to-server authentication. OAuth is essentially a way for us to ensure that a user who's authenticated to Link doesn't have to provide separate credentials when they go to access their Exchange UM or the web access component role in SharePoint, for example. We don't want that user to have to resupply their username and password. They've already been authenticated to Link, and we'd like to be able to translate or delegate that authentication process to one of these non-Link server roles. So inside of the Link server organization, we know the user is authenticated. We've got a token and a certificate for that user. So therefore, they're a valid user in the Link environment. But when we leave the Link realm or the Link boundary and go to an Exchange Unified Messaging server or to a web access component server, for example, we don't have that same trust established or enabled. In the past, we've had to provide creds or pass something on. So OAuth is our process for adding or providing that cross-platform authentication between server roles. We also have the concept of XMPP. So when we're requesting our public edge server certificates, if we're going to be federating with an XMPP organization, we might have to define some additional namespaces required around that. There's also a couple of certificate management changes that we've defined. The first one, right, is when doing a certificate request. We have a parameter now for all SIP domains. We're finding some organizations have dozens, if not more, of SIP domains due to mergers and acquisitions or branding, for example, over the years. And adding those manually, it's easy to leave one off or have a typo inside of that certificate request, causing you to then have to reissue that certificate request later. Adding the all SIP domains, we'll say all of the SIP domains defined in Topology Builder we'll place on that certificate request and ensure we don't have that that potential, essentially, for administrator error, or less likely. There's another option on the set CS certificate, which is the dash role switch. And so the dash role switch is around certificate management. Not only do we have the certificate process of requesting certificates up front and then having those certificates deployed and on the machines, what we're finding is that after you've had Link Server running for 1, 2, or 3 years or the expiration period of your certificates, you have to go through and request new certificates and replace the certificates that are on the box today. Right now, when you replace that certificate goes live as soon as you import and assign that certificate on your Link Server roles. The dash role commandlet allows you to import the certificate, assign it, but assign it with a specific date and time that you want that certificate request to go live. So now you can import and assign the certificate, you know, Friday afternoon at 1 p.m., but tell it to go live at Saturday at 2 in the morning, for example, when we don't have users live on the system, so we don't have to be up at 2 in the morning to actually import and assign the certificate inside. So essentially making it easier for the operations and maintenance of the environment when adding or replacing certificates in the organization. We mentioned before this concept of OAuth, or open authentication. This is our link to Exchange or link to SharePoint authentication bridge, so allowing a link authenticated user to also be viewed as a valid or authenticated user in the other realm, such as Exchange UM or Exchange Archiving as part of the Unified Contact Store, or requesting access to the WAC role, for example, to upload or to view a PowerPoint that's been added to a meeting. The coexistence, as you can see, is Link 2013 to Exchange 2013, SharePoint 2013, and Office 365. This is a new feature in the 2013 wave of products. We don't have the open authentication capabilities in 2010 or prior. This has been added in to help reduce, as we said, this concept of not requiring additional username and password prompts when connecting to a non-link system inside of the organization for an existing authenticated user. The next step, after we've went through, defined our topology, published it, ran setup, etc., is to go through and actually validate that we have a consistent or healthy topology in the organization. There is a concept that we introduced in Link Server 2010 that we've extended and augmented in 2013 called synthetic transactions. So one way, or the historical method of monitoring, is to have a tool like System Center install an agent on the servers, or maybe do it agentless, but interrogate the servers to look for event log entries, you know, disk space, memory utilization, processor utilization, logs, and to find out events or actions that may cause an outage or a service awareness issue. We found that this to be helpful, but it often creates what we call a lot of noise in the system, where you're getting alerts coming back and, I don't know, you received an event error 1216, which says that component on DLLX failed to register. Does that mean users can't IM? Does it mean voice is down? Does it mean that one of the servers needs a patch, right? It becomes very administratively burdensome to go through all of these events and determine if action is required or not. The concept of synthetic transactions says, rather than just looking at those event log entries and reporting, let's actually run a transaction that says, test an IM session between Andrew and Ewan, or two sample configured users in the environment, and is it successful? Test an audio call from Andrew to Ewan. Test a video call from Andrew to Ewan. Test a conference call between Andrew, Ewan, and Mario, right? And by actually testing or synthesizing that transaction, we know is IM up, is an audio session able to be placed, is a video call able to be placed, is a web conference able to be established, for example. In Link 2010, we ran these synthetic transactions from the same backplane as the Link servers themselves. So we put a what we call a watcher node in System Center. It would execute these transactions against the Link servers, and we'd have an awareness of the Link infrastructure to know if it was able to successfully execute these. If it was not, we generate an alert. We know we have a user awareness issue we have to resolve, or a service issue we have to resolve. With Link 2013, these synthetic transactions now can be run away from that server backplane and closer to where the end users are. So we can put the watcher nodes at the end user locations, as well as on the internet. So this ensures not only do we know that the Link servers are healthy and responding, but now we're testing for components in the path between the user and the server themselves. Routers, switches, firewalls, network links, WAN, right? All the other components that also might fail and lead to a loss of service for the end user. So our capability or our health metric capability from synthetic transactions goes from just providing server type, user to server health to all the endpoints in the path from user to server. If we see that failure, we know we have something along the path from the user to that server that's causing that synthetic transaction to fail. We also have the test CS database. This will give us testing against our backend SQL database. We can validate that database server is up, it's healthy, the instance is responding, and has all the configurations required relevant to our CMS. So happy to have that additional layer of troubleshooting or awareness being provided in 2013. Office Web Apps, or the WAC Web Access Component Server role, is something that's not part of Link 2013. This is part of the SharePoint family of products. This comes from the Office folks delivering the Office Web Apps experience. It's a separate install experience, right? Separate setup experience. This is all part of the other side. From the Link portion, we define a path in Topology Builder to the discovery URL of that Web Access Component server role. Once we define that link in Topology Builder, and we can take a look at this later in the demo itself, right? We show the FQDNs. Once the FQDNs are there, we can then go into PowerShell and import a module that then feeds in or reads in the XML configuration information of that into the Link environment, and now that Web Access Component server role is available for our Link users for uploading content and sharing content for all of them to see. So we can see here the associations, then finally by running the import module, specifying the namespaces around that, and then having that Web Access Component server role be available for our Link users. Take a brief detour and walk you through the hardware and software requirements. I'm going to go through this relatively quickly. I don't need to read all the information on the slide, but you'll have these available for download. And as I said, if you're not part of the TAP or RDP, I'd recommend waiting till closer to RTM as we publish our finalized guidance around this. Our topology changes, right? Now that we're moving the AVMCU and XMPP gateway onto that front-end server role, for larger organizations, we're recommending more than 8 cores on that front-end server to support that additional load that we're placing. As we also look at capabilities like HD video conferencing, that has significantly higher CPU utilization than VGA video conferencing or SIF video conferencing, for example. Video is a high CPU utilization task or component part of Link. We provide the multi-view and the HD capabilities, but without the CPU backend to support that, right, you won't be seeing that the higher-end video resolution. Our scalability guidance, we mentioned also, we're targeting significantly more, up to potentially 12 to 20 servers per pool, and potentially 12,500 users per front-end server, which is more than what we had in Link Server 2010. Hardware specs. Our typical platform around Link and Exchange is the concept of a two-socket server. It's typical for organizations to have the choice to buy 2 or 4-way servers. There's typically a price differential between a 2-socket server and a 4-socket server, and we find it less expensive to deploy multiple 2-socket servers than a smaller number of 4-socket servers. Part of that is around availability. We like this concept of bricks, or having multiple individual servers configured identically with the expectation that at any time, one or more of those is going to be down. Might be scheduled in terms of patching or maintenance, might be unscheduled in terms of a specific hardware failure or network failure, chassis failure, something on the server. So two socket boxes, 8 to 24 CPUs, right? We're seeing a lot of quad and hex and additional core CPUs on the marketplace. NICs, at least dual 1 gig or potentially even 10 gig Ethernet. This comes around, again, the concept of the high-definition video and mixing. As we start to add those high-definition video streams, you're seeing a lot of network utilization on these boxes. The main difference we want to point out on this slide is the concept of storage on the front-end server. Historically, we typically had a little RAID 1 set on front-end servers, and we had maybe multiple RAID 1 sets on our SQL back-end infrastructure. If you saw the architecture session, or if you didn't see, you can rewatch it. One of the major changes we did is to offload the processing of transient data from the back-end SQL infrastructure to the front-end servers. So things like presence and status, for example, that are transient in nature, and if the server were to crash, it's not the end of the world, right? User will just re-register their presence on the second or their secondary front-end server in that pool. We don't have to store that in SQL. That reduces our load on the SQL back-end, both from a disk perspective and from a network I/O perspective between front-end and back-end. The second advantage to that is it allows us to lose the back-end but still have the concept of presence and registration capabilities for all of our clients. So we're no longer as dependent on SQL being available to ensure that that pool is available for users to work on. But the hardware impact of that is we've now moved more storage requirements up to the front-end server rule. So we're now recommending if we're doing the 12,500 users per front-end server, we're saying we need 8 drives on an Enterprise Edition roll to handle those 12,500 folks. We'll have better guidance as we get closer to RTM of what if you're putting 500 or 1,500 or 2,500, right? But in essence, if you're doing the higher end scale towards front end, we'll be moving some of those drives from the back end server infrastructure to the front end server infrastructure to accommodate those architectural changes. We also recommend 16 gigs of RAM. We're not a 32 or 64 or 96 gig RAM consumer. The primary architectural components we use in Link are the processor and the network interface. So front-end server and back-end, we have the additional storage requirements, but we're not memory-intensive as some of the other applications. For the RTC local and the Link local databases, we recommend starting those at 4 gigs for each one of those instances. That's a little smaller than we've seen in the past, primarily due to the fact it's just the permanent data. Your buddy list, response groups, for example, other smaller subsets of what we were capturing in terms of presence and everything else that is now being stored out on the front-end boxes. If you optionally were to deploy a director, for example, right, we have our specs for those. Same concept, dual socket servers, but simpler configuration. A SQL back-end server is very similar to what you see today. The back-end specs are still assuming that fully loaded Enterprise Edition pool. Our guidance in terms of what that would look like from a subset of a fully loaded Enterprise Edition pool will be less than what we're showing you here. In terms of NICs, as we said, when we're looking at HD video and or HD video, multi-view video, and multi-view conferencing, we're recommending now more than 1 gig, more than a single 1 gig Ethernet card. We're starting at a couple. We do now support NIC teaming on those as well, so if you want to deploy a NIC team for load balancing or fault tolerance, we have that support and link for adding NIC teams at your OS level. Operating system, we support Windows Server 2008 R2 SP1, as well as Windows Server 2012 for Link Server 2013. Windows Server 20, I want to say that was RTM'd last week. Was that just a few days ago that we announced? I think it was last week, actually. We finally announced the RTM of Windows Server 2012, so that will hit general availability relatively soon and provide yet another platform, essentially, for deploying Link Server 2013 on. SQL, we require either SQL 2008 R2 with SP1 or higher, or SQL Server 2012 potentially coming up as well. As an FYI, right, we call out that when we install Link Server 2013 on our front end or other server roles in the organization, we do install a copy of SQL Express and Link 2010, that was SQL 2008. If Link 2013, That SQL Express is SQL 2012. and final one, if you missed it right, is the we no longer have support for SQL clustering. We see SQL clustering as reliant on a single copy of the data, which is a single point of failure. SQL mirroring allows you to have two completely disparate SQL instances replicating from one node to the other. So a loss of either node or either storage platform ensures that that SQL backend is still available. That is help. Question. Yep, SQL always on or SQL mirroring. Oh, sorry, not always on. Mirroring is supported, always on, and clustering is not. The other aspect of this, right, is the SQL mirroring becomes less important as we no longer have that reliance on the SQL backend for the service availability. And so with the SQL backend being dropped, users will still be able to register, sign in, perform all their link functionality. If they make changes to their contact list, for example, we'll queue those up on their front-end server. And when you restore the SQL backend, we will then propagate those changes to be stored permanently. So you can have an outage of hours or days. We don't recommend days, right? Because any transient changes, if you were to lose those front-end servers and the back-end servers at the same time, we would lose that that buddy list changes, for example, that people have made since the back-end was unavailable. Software prereqs. Like we said, there's the Windows Identity Foundation, which we use for the OAuth authentication components, PowerShell V3. If you have Link Server 2010, we require CU6. That shipped earlier this year, I want to say back in June, or later, right? Well, obviously, we'll be continuing to release cumulative updates for the Link Server 2010 platform. .NET Framework 4.5, the Windows Desktop Experience. Windows Desktop Experience on the server platform brings in media support. With Windows Server 2008, the Windows Desktop Experience installs a whole host of features that some of them are not required for us. We only need the media and codec aspects. We went to the Windows Server 2012 team and said, look, we really only need a subset of Windows Desktop Experience. Can you break that up for us so we can only install the codecs and whatnot that are required? So on Windows Server 2012, you're just installing the portions of Windows Desktop Experience specifically required for Link Server 2013. We also have MSMQ and the directory service integration on the front-end servers. That's what's capturing our archiving data before submitting it to the Link storage service, which then will arbitrate whether or not to send it to Exchange 2013 or SQL as a back-end, depending on what you've configured in Topology Builder. Your admin tools, as of today, they're not yet ready for Windows 8. We're working on that, but are supported on Windows 7 and 2008 R2. We do require a PowerShell V3 for your administration component. Active Directory Forest and Domain Functional Levels, 2003, 2008, R2, or 2012. We support all four. We recommend kind of moving forward, right? 2003 is now 10 years old, but have support all the way back to that domain and forest functional level if so choose. We still require a hardware load balancer for our web services. So our simple URLs, for example, our front-end URLs, because browsers don't have the concept of DNS load balancing. If you're familiar with Link Server 2010, we introduced a concept called DNS load balancing at the client level. What this is we publish our front-end server pool with four servers, four IP addresses. The client gets a DNS request, gets all four IP addresses and four names. It has a little algorithm that's unique per client to randomize the four server names and have a preferred order. So each client has its own preferred order for the four front-end servers in the pool. If its preferred server is not available, goes to the second, goes to the third, goes to the fourth. And so by adding that load balancing logic at the Link client itself, and that's true on the Link client or a Link Phone Edition client, we no longer need a load balancer for SIP traffic in the organization. The clients have the built-in logic to arbitrate through that. The one that doesn't is browser-based traffic. Browsers don't have the capability to do this concept of DNS load balancing, so we use recommend a hardware load balancer to provide the load balancing services for the web services component. Virtualization. We've also changed our virtualization support stance. With Link Server 2010, we supported the Link server roles to be virtualized or physical, but we had a support boundary constraint of four processor cores due to the fact that our hypervisor platform and our test platform essentially was limited to four cores. With Link Server 2013 and support for Windows Server 2012 Hyper-V, we've removed that four-core support boundary and will now allow you to deploy virtual servers with as many cores as a Windows Server Hyper-V guest can support. And so we've increased essentially the processing or CPU capabilities of a physical host and virtual guest that can be leveraged for Link Server 2013. We also this also applies for virtualization vendors who are part of SVVP, or the Server Virtualization Validation Program. This ensures that you have the capability for running Link Server 2013 on other vendors as well, besides Windows Server 2008 R2 or Windows Server 2012 Hyper-V. The features that we don't yet support are quick and live migration, dynamic memory, and VM replica. We are looking at some of these, specifically dynamic memory. We're going through the testing phases right now to see whether we might be able to support these. But around quick live migration and VM replica, the rationale for the support stance today is around the concept of media and meetings. If we have a meeting running with, you know, 3, 12, 100 participants, for example, or several of these on a specific instance, and we allow the hypervisor to fail over or move that to another server role in the organization, that meeting experience is significantly degraded for the participants. We see kind of random drops, disconnects, roster changes, inconsistent among all the participants, and it can be several minutes before that meeting experience comes back to full fidelity. We're working with the groups right now to see what we can do, but it looks like right at RTM that we won't have support for the quick live migration and the VM replica capabilities due to that degraded meeting experience. So there's a technical rationale behind the support stance there. As I said, we're looking at dynamic memory, going through testing to see what will work out there, but for now, it's listed on the unsupported now because we haven't confirmed that there are no technical issues with it. We've also added support for virtualization to the planning tool. Ewan can show us that as we're going through. So as you're going through planning, you can mark out whether servers will be virtual or physical, and we'll take that guidance in when determining what those look like. Next portion is around clients. We have a major change in the client deployment, which is essentially Link client is no longer part of the Link team or a separate MSI. Link is now part of Office. And so when you install Office 2013, there are modules, Word, Excel, PowerPoint, Outlook. Link is just another module as part of that Office MSI. Two ways to install Office 2013. You can do the traditional MSI plus patch approach, or you can use the new AppV streaming, right? So you define an Office package centrally, and you stream out this version of Office 2013 on demand to your participants. That can include the Link 2013 client as well. And that, I don't know if any of you have been to some of the Office sessions, but they're walking through a lot of demos around that. Click to run or the click to install means that you have a functioning version of Office in as little as 30 seconds on your workstation. We're streaming the information on demand. You can start the streaming, put your machine in a standby, disconnect the network. When you resume network connectivity, we will continue to stream that down. It's significantly more robust and error condition aware. It's also easier to patch. You patch the one central version. Everything else is patched. An example of this would be we released the Office 2013 preview in June. We had several hundred thousand people download the Office 2013 preview using click to run from our Office 365 servers or hosted capability. We realized within 3 or 4 days of release that we had a bug, and there's actually a later build that's slightly better that we should use for streaming. We replaced the online stream version, and with a matter of days, all several hundred thousand people worldwide had a newer version of Office 2013 with no install, no reconfiguration. Most people weren't even aware unless they went into help about and noticed that the last four digits changed from 1401 to 1406, right? And so the click to run or the streaming version of Office we see as kind of the future of Office deployments. Leveraging that for your Link deployment capabilities should assist or simplify the concept of the Link client deployment. We still have the option, however, of the MSI, right? So if you have people familiar with packaging and pushing out a package and distributing it to your organization, we use the MSI package, the Office customization tool to go in and define which specific modules, or maybe you want to add your brand or support information right around that. Go through and create that config XML file and push that package out to all your workstations and computers. Both deployment options are supported, but essentially the big change, right, is Link is no longer a standalone client that you'll have to push out or manage. It's now part of your Office 2013 suite that people will deploy or complete. For customers who want to manage QoS or DiffServe characteristics at the switch or router level, we still support the option of defining the media port range at the client. So there's two choices for QoS or DiffServe. One, the network team trusts the Active Directory and client team to define a policy in Active Directory, a group policy that says the Link client is allowed to tag packets with the expedited forwarding or assured forwarding characteristics for voice and video. The second choice is the network team does not trust the Active Directory team to allow clients to tag packets, but will tell the clients to use a specific port range for voice and video media. Once you define those port ranges here, when we send media out on those port ranges, your routers or switches will pick that up and will then tag those packets with the appropriate expedited or assured forwarding. Enhanced privacy mode was introduced in Link Server 2010. And it provides capabilities around restricting who can see your presence. It's relatively simple. It says if you have an executive and you don't want the entire org to see that exec's presence, only people on the exec's contact list, you check the box on the server side to enable enhanced privacy mode. That person then has a choice to say, let everyone see my presence or only set my contact list to see my presence status. The one caveat is this only works for Link 2010 and Link 2013 clients. They are privacy mode aware. If you are running OCS 2007 R1 or R2 clients, they are not aware of this concept of advanced privacy mode. So, manageability tools. I'm going to give you two quick slides, and we'll jump over to the demo. First one is a planning tool. We've added support for a slew of new features. Ewan will walk us through all of these, showing the conference settings, voice settings, right, UM, persistent chat, mobility, and topology builder. The big changes here are around defining routing at the trunk level instead of at the gateway level. We'll talk a lot more about this afternoon in the voice session, and being able to define some of our concepts like SQL mirroring and our pool pairing inside a topology builder for our HA and failover purposes. So with that, let's turn it over to Ewan, and we'll show you the changes live versus looking at screenshots.
That's great. Thanks, Andrew. So who have you deployed OCS 2007? One or two? Just a quick show of hands. Okay, Link 2010? Right, fair number. So you may think back to OCS 2007, and there was a number of server roles. It was kind of complex to think about which server roles you needed, where they were going to be co-located, which server roles and components you could co-locate. And with Link 2010, we tried to simplify that story a lot by reducing the number of server roles we had and by making the co-location simpler. We've done that again with 2013. And we've tried to make the deployment process for Link 2013 pretty much as simple as possible by giving you, first of all, a planning tool that walks you through the process of deciding how many servers you need, having a look at what the base hardware is going to be looking like, what components you want to enable, what components you want to disable. And then we have the topology builder, which is going to actually help you deploy that into your organization. So this is a preview version of the planning tool. Could change as time goes on as we get closer to RTM. But let's get started with our initial workloads that we want to deploy to our Link users. So this wizard, probably if you're going to sit down and do this for real, it's going to take a little bit more time. I'm just going to run through this and point out the important stuff for you. Who of you have used the planning tool for Link 2010? Okay, some people have. So if you're familiar with this, you'll see some new stuff. If this is new to you, this is what you're going to do first off before you start thinking about installing your Link servers. So we say whether we want to enable the audio or video conferencing workload for our users, which is probably quite likely. And related to that, we can specify whether we're going to have dial-in conferencing as well. So that means we'd have to have a conferencing attendant and a conferencing announcement service application. So when users dial in, they can join the conferences from a public telephony network. We can also specify whether we want to enable web conferencing for our users, and that can be web conferencing for scheduling meetings either internally or externally. And you can control whether you have internal or external access through a later component in the wizard. We can control whether we want to enable enterprise voice here as well. Once we enable enterprise voice, that means we can do calls internally and calls externally for our users. And we can specify whether we want to use Exchange Unified Messaging for our voicemail. So when our phone goes ring no answer, we can redirect that SIP request off to a UM server, and the UM server can take your voicemail message. We can also control whether we want call admission control. Call admission control is a feature that we had in 2010. It's a feature we've got in 2013. And it gives us the ability to control the amount of bandwidth that we use between locations. So if you have relatively constrained bandwidth, or if you just want to make sure that your voice and your video data does not overwhelm the network links between locations, you can use call admission control to stop people making calls in the instance where the network is too heavily used by link traffic already. So that's an experience users are already familiar with. If they try and make a call on a regular telephone and the network's too busy, they'll just get a busy time. It's the same concept here, essentially. They won't be able to make a call if we exceed certain network limits. So it allows you to control what Link does from that network perspective. We have the option for monitoring as well. This monitoring role is not the kind of synthetic transactions that Andrew was talking about earlier on, or the SCOMS type piece. This monitoring is to monitor the call quality, the audio quality of calls. It's to monitor how many instant messaging sessions are being run. It's to monitor how many telephone calls are being made. So it really gives you a lot of rich information around how much people are using your Link infrastructure. And also, if you have any troubleshooting scenarios that you need to work through, it can give you a lot of very good detail on potentially what the issue was. So you'll see any errors coming up inside here. If users, for example, complain that they're not able to make a high-definition video call, then by looking at the monitoring server, you'll actually see that they don't have sufficient hardware potentially to support that call. So the monitoring server role in 2010 and 2013 is kind of optional. Really, from a deployment perspective, it's something that you need to have in your environment. We also have the ability to archive data. And we had this previously in Link 2010, where we could archive off instant messaging content to a SQL database. With 2013, we've got the ability to archive off to Exchange as well. Assuming you have Exchange 2013 in your organization, you can enable your users to archive their data off their Exchange mailbox. We can put in the persistent chat service, which Andrew mentioned earlier on. So that just gives users the ability to join and communicate in chat rooms and catch up with chat rooms all from the same Link client, as opposed to having a separate client as we previously had. So they can do all their unified communications through that one UI. From a mobility perspective, we can enable mobility. We've got some more information coming out at some point in the future around the mobility piece. And we can control whether we allow federation. So this allows us to federate and talk to other organizations and public IM providers. So things like Yahoo, MSN, and other people who have OTS or Link infrastructures. We can also say if we want to have high availability. The high availability option here is really around whether we're going to have high availability for our services. Things like the SQL, the SQL services. Do we want to have SQL mirroring in the environment? So if a SQL server fails, then we have another copy that we can simply fail over to. So if I say no there, I'm not going to get mirrored SQL. If I say yes there, I will end up with mirrored SQL. We support both IPv4 and v6. You can choose which one you have in your organization. And then we can choose whether we want to have a separate disaster recovery site. If I say yes, I want to enable disaster recovery, that means I'll have a separate Link site that we can fail over to if we have an issue with pools in one data center. Okay, so that's my feature overview complete. So it's a relatively painless process to go through that wizard and say, I want these features, please enable them for me. The next thing I have to do is design my sites. My first site I'm going to have here will have a pool in it to support my users. So I'll just call this site Gold Coast. Based on the questions that I've already asked, been asked and answered, you can see there's a whole number of features here that are selected and enabled. You can see disaster recovery is not enabled because I chose not to enable that there. I specify the number of users that I want, so I'll say we've got 5,000 users here, and we'll probably stick a few hundred users in the cloud as well. We then have to specify the SIP domain that we want to use. And you can add multiple SIP domains in here if you do have a bunch of SIP domains that you support inside your topology. And then we go through and we specify really what the workload looks like from a user perspective when they're connecting in during the day and doing various things. So over the next few screens, we're specifying really the concurrency and the feature set that the users are going to use so we can decide what kind of hardware we're going to need at the back end of that. So, for example, whether high-definition video is enabled, that's going to affect the hardware that we have. So we have voice settings here as well. This is the kind of information that you would be able to get from your existing telephony guys. Potentially, they will already have an idea of how many calls are made, how many outbound calls are made, how many inbound calls are made, and you can use those statistics to punch into here when you're enabling enterprise voice. We can then specify the voice infrastructure, whether we're connecting to a PSTN or whether we are using SIP trunking. And then we can say, from a unified messaging perspective, how many times people are going to check their voicemail per day. This is the kind of thing, if you don't have in already, you may not know, so pilot it and start to monitor it. When you start looking at the monitoring server, you'll start being able to get out this kind of information around how many calls users make per day.
I was going to say, we have a joke around that at Microsoft of how many exchange. So during the planning tool, right, how do you size the number of UM servers for a Blink organization?
I don't know. How do you
size it, right? The joke is the answer is two. No matter what size organization, it's very hard to exceed two UM servers. Inside at Microsoft for 100,000, we have four. But we don't exceed those that much. The rationale behind that is as you move to Exchange UM, people get their voicemail in Outlook, and the number of times they check from the phone diminishes greatly. We get around 60 to 80,000 inbound calls to UM each day. Of those, only about 30,000 of them actually leave a voicemail, right? So half the people who get, or two-thirds of the folks who get voicemail just hang up. For the ones who do leave a voicemail, so of this 30,000 voicemails left per day, how many times do you think the subscriber access number is checked to actually check the voicemail of our 30,000 voicemails left per day? It's around 200 to 300. And so literally, the rationale here, we're showing in the planning tool checking voicemail four times per day, but the end case of having voicemail on your mobile device or on your mail client is that people just look at the voicemail there, they either play it, look at the transcription, they very rarely go back to their phone and check the voicemail. So not to say that that happens immediately after the transition, but at some point post-transition, the number of voicemail subscriber access numbers goes down a lot less.
Thanks for that. So external user access, if you want to have edge services so that your users can use Link outside of the firewall, we can enable that, and that'll include edge servers in the topology. And from a security perspective, we can say that we want to deploy directors to allow the authentication of external users before they hit the front-end servers on the internal network. We can specify people are going to be using persistent chat. Again, that's something you probably have to monitor if it's not a feature you've had previously. And from a mobility perspective, we can specify the number of users who we would think would be connecting in from mobile clients. Typically, you're going to co-locate your mediation servers with your front-end servers. If for any reason you need to break them out, you can do. So you can deploy additional mediation servers there. And if you have branch sites, if you have small sites where you don't want a full link infrastructure in place, but you do want some telephony services, you can add them in here too. So what that ends up with, once we finish the planning tool successfully, is a nice picture. Which
let's zoom in.
Yeah, let's zoom in and see some of that detail. So this is really cool. Based on everything I've told it, the tool has gone away and created this diagram of what my infrastructure is going to look like. So I can see here, because I asked for disaster recovery, because I asked for high availability, rather, we've got a SQL database here, and we've got a mirrored database there, so I've got high availability in my back-end store. If I have a look at my front-end servers, yeah, there we've got a front-end server, and that's the stuff that we're running on it, so the AV conferencing and a bunch of other stuff. If I actually drill into these servers, then what it's going to show me is the hardware requirements of the servers at the top, and then the report requirements for the servers at the bottom. So if you have a need for DNS load balancing hardware, load balancing, and you need to talk to your networking guys to get this set up, you just give them this information. Let me go back to here. So just quickly, we also get a diagram of what we look like from an edge perspective. So this shows us what servers you're going to have in the edge, what servers you're going to have in the perimeter network. and what kind of IP addresses that you'll need for those. If we go to the Edge Admin report, this is going to give you pretty detailed information to give to your firewall people, so your security team, to tell them specifically what ports we need open and what protocols we're going to use. So you can give this to your security team, and that's going to save you a ton of time instead of hunting through TetNet trying to look for which ports are required and then going back a week later and saying it's not working, try these ones. And
calling you in.
Yeah, give me a call. We've got a DNS report as well. So this gives you a huge amount of configuration information around what you need to make this topology work. Yes, sir? Okay, so the question was, is there an easier way to export it? Beautiful segue into my next demo. Thank you very much. So what I can do is take this and export it to Visio. I know. I can export it to Excel as well. So whichever you prefer. And
yeah, it doesn't show all the port information.
Okay, so inside Visio, here we go. It gives you, this is the thing, you export it to Visio, email it to your boss, looks like you worked super hard, take the rest of the day off. This shows you, this just quickly goes through there. It doesn't give quite all the detailed information. If we have a look at the Excel, and there we go. This gives you some more information, gives you port requirements here. So is that what you're looking for?
The firewall rules. Is it right, look over on the tabs? Are they on the new tabs?
Where are we? Firewall, I think. Firewall report. So that shows you.
We weren't even sure.
Look at that. Come on. Whoever put that in, thank you to them. I got a round of applause after it.
We did have a lot of feedback. I was going to say, it's on the team's request. I don't know if it's made the planning tool yet, but there we go. It's in the planning tool now. That
it's
was a very big feedback request from 2010 to produce this one. If you tried to screenshot the other one, you would take screenshots, but you'd have to scroll down and screenshot and scroll down and screenshot and kind of merge it together to get the full report. Now it's in Excel, and you get the full page.
Okay. So that's the planning tool, a whole bunch of awesome. We can take that information and pull it into Topology Builder to actually deploy this. And I'll just give you a quick look at Topology Builder. Topology Builder is the thing that you're going to do before you deploy your first server to set up your environment. And it's the thing you're going to use on an ongoing basis to make configuration changes to the organization in terms of the way you deploy your infrastructure. So I will very quickly create a new topology. What it does is saves out this as a TB XML, so a topology builder XML file. And I'll replace that. It just asks me a couple questions to get me started. So it asks for my SIP domain. And this is information I've put into the planning tool. I could just import the planning tool's XML directly into here, and then that's my organization topology set up. But just to show you this, I won't. So I can put in additional supported SIP domains if I have them. I can put in a name for my first site, so the same as I did in Topology Builder. So I'll just call this site one. This is a site, massively imaginative. This is in the Gold Coast. Whoops.
The coast.
It's in Queensland, and it's in Australia. So that's it. That's created my organization. If I just go to finish, obviously it's not an organization with anything in it, but it is a topology. So inside my site, you can see we've got Link 2010 there. And if we have a look at Link 2010 compared to what we've got in Link 2013, you can see there's actually less for Link 2013 than there was for Link 2010. So you can see that we no longer have archiving servers. We don't have a pool of archiving servers anymore. It's because it's all co-located. It's sitting on the front-end server. The same with the monitoring server. We do not have to have a separate monitoring server. We can just co-locate that. We don't have the AV conferencing pools either. So we've got less stuff to worry about deploying. You have less server roles to think about deploying, less considerations around co-locating. We do obviously have the persistent chat pools. That's new. And then we've got our shared components down here, so the SQL and so on. Now, I'll just very briefly create an enterprise pool. So firing through here. My pool FQDM will be pool1.microsoft.com. And I'll have fe1.microsoft.com as the server inside of there. Make sure you spell the server names correctly here. This data gets uploaded into the SQL database. When you then run setup on the local machine, it connects off to the SQL database based off the SCP record and Active Directory, retrieves what should be installed in that server, and it just installs that. Now, if the server isn't mentioned in the database because you got it wrong here, then we don't install anything. Setup completes successfully without actually doing anything. There we go. Next. So then we can specify what we want to enable on here. So I'll just go for conferencing and enterprise voice. You could optionally specify call admission control archiving and monitoring on this pool. I won't because it makes my demo much longer. We'll co-locate the mediation server, and I'm not going to enable an edge pool at this time, just to keep my demo nice and short. The first thing I'm going to have to do here is specify a SQL Server store, and this is going to be the guy where we store all of our configuration information, and I'll just put it in an instance called link. And we can say that we want it to be in a mirroring relationship. If it is in a mirroring relationship, then we can specify a second SQL Server here to mirror to. Now, who of you in the room know how to set up SQL mirroring, just by show of hands? Wow, that's more than I thought. That's about seven people. Well done, you. You don't have to know anything about SQL mirroring, so don't worry. When you publish this from Topology Builder, Topology Builder goes off and it creates the SCP record and Active Directory, so all the link servers know where to find the configuration information. It goes off to SQL Servers, creates the databases, it sets up the mirroring relationship. I have no idea how to set up mirroring. Topology Builder does it all for me. It's beautiful. Go to next. We need to specify a file store. The file store is going to be... The file store is where we keep a lot of stuff related to our infrastructure. So if I go to my server, I actually already have a server called SQL1 with a shared folder. We have things like a persistent chat folder. We've got various web services, so some of you may recognize the address book files here, collaboration metadata. There's a ton of stuff that needs to be there, and that'll be on our SQL servers, or potentially on a SQL server or on a DFS share. We can specify alternate web service URLs if we want to. And then we need to specify the Office web app server, so I will just say owas.microsoft.com, and then that gives us that URL. That's all you have to do. You set up your Office web app server, and it just works at that point. So there's no additional configuration needed from you guys from a link perspective for OWASP. Yes?
What would it do if you assigned, if you directed it to a SQL cluster node?
If you directed what to a SQL cluster node?
The SQL instance? I don't know if we check that it's a cluster and block you, but we would say it's an unsupported configuration. So it may work technically, but... If you call us, we'll say, and you have issues with it, we would say put it on a standalone. We haven't tested that scenario, so we don't know what works. That's so an easier way to answer the question.
But don't try it, because not supported.
Correct.
There we go. And then I will finish that. So that gives us our front end pool, and you can see inside here that we have the configuration of the SQL store created. When I go to publish that topology, what Topology Builder is going to do is run through, and it allows me here to specify the SQL paths. So that's worth being aware of. Topology Builder is actually checking all the time that what I'm doing is right and supported and configured correctly. If you go up to here and that little icon there is red, that means you've messed something up. And when you click on it, you'll get some text down at the bottom of the screen that tells you what's wrong. Also, if you go to publish it and there's anything, we will check the topology again. We'll do things like go off to Active Directory and check that every server you've specified in the topology actually exists as a computer account inside of AD. So there's a lot of error checking to make sure that when you publish this to your SQL database, everything is perfect. And that's pretty much all we've got for the tools.
All right. We are really pushing time. We added some migration content into this session. We knew we'd be pushed to try to get it all covered, but we wanted to have it for reference material since there's not a lot of this publicly available yet. I'm going to try to get through this in about 30 seconds. Essentially, your Link 2013 migration experience is the same as previous. You build a new Link 2013 pool. You move users from your OCSR2 pool or your Link 2010 pool to Link 2013. The main difference is with Link 2013, you can deploy either the Link 2013 client first or the Link 2013 server first. The 2013 client talks to Link 2010 or Link 2013. In the past, we used to force you to do a server first, then a client migration. Slides will highlight that. We also have the support for persistent chat, which versions work, don't work. The other one I wanted to point out is our voice routing coexistence. The 2013 preview for an outbound call with a home server on R2 and a mediation server on 2013 is not supported. Other than that, we will route both inbound and outbound calls kind of regardless of your R2, 2010, or 2013 pool or client. The other one that's not supported is a Link 2013 SBA against a Link 2010 pool. So if you're deploying the new SBAs, pair them with Link 2013 pools, you'll be in a supported scenario. A couple more quick ones on migrations. Summary slide. After this session, you should have a lot of knowledge around setup and deployment. 45 seconds of knowledge on migration. Feel free to I apologize for the time, but we really wanted to show you the tools. It's a little more interesting to watch them than to watch a lot of slides. It's there for your reference for download after the event. So with that, you know the related content. This afternoon is customer panel, voice improvements, tomorrow is Link PBX and enterprise networking. So let's get to the important part, which is our random number generator in Excel. And we're looking for the high count. So anybody over 3,000 in the, so if you haven't done this before, look at your badge. We're looking for the highest number in the room to put as our high number. Anybody over 3,000? Couple, what's the highest number we've got? 3,200? 31? Yell out if you've got over 3,000. 3,376. Anybody higher than that? That's our high number, 3,376. So now we're going to do equals rand between, and that's D3, D4. First, so the closest badge to 2982 is the first lucky winner. Anyone have? 2916, we're pretty close. I think, anybody closer? 2962, we're within 20. All right, 2962.
There you go, sir.
I think it's 62, actually.
Oh, 62. Yeah. Oh, okay, sure. I'll have that back. Thank you.
I might not be able to do the math quickly in my head.
There you go.
Lucky winner number two will be Rand between. Used to buy. And our, oops. D0, D3. I can't use Excel again. D3. 3249. Looks like our high number probably comes pretty close. Who's, we're too close. What do we have? 3233. We're within 16. Anybody closer? All right. We're pushed on time, so let's get that one out. Equals ran between D3, D4. 635, we're going to the early registers. Pardon? 639, we're within four. All right. That one is simple. Equals ran between D3, D4. Yeah, it's ineligible. That's what you're 1112. 1136, we're within 24. Anybody within 24? Going once? Going twice?
Matt at the back.
Sold. Thank you very much, everyone. Appreciate your time. Sorry for pushing the limits.